from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was raised Catholic, but in her 50s she learned her parents were Jewish and that many of her relatives died in the Holocaust. Her family fled to England and narrowly escaped Nazi tanks when she was a toddler. In her new memoir, Prague Winter, Albright explores her family history and the story of the birth of Czechoslovakia. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Former United States Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the first woman to hold that cabinet position, joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. She served as the nation's 64th Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton from 1997 to 2001 and held positions on Capitol Hill, in the National Security Council, and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She is Professor of International Relations at Georgetown and a 2012 recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom awarded by President Barack Obama. She also is Director on the Board of the Council on Foreign Relations, and her recently published book is a memoir called Prague Spring, and it's the story of her family and its survival, as well as a historic narrative on the upheavals in Eastern Europe and the history of modern-day Czechoslovakia. We welcome her back to Forum. Good to see you again.
Great to be with you, Michael. Thank you.
Delighted to have you back here. I guess the place to begin was, I was remembering our last interview, and you candidly and quite poignantly talked about the biggest regret and perhaps the biggest mistake of your tenure as Secretary of State being Rwanda. And you've said this a number of times publicly. And I thought we may go into your tenure here. I want to go into your book, talk about all of these things. What's the thing you're most proud of?
The thing I'm most proud of as Secretary of State was what we were able to do in Kosovo. Because I knew quite a lot about the former Yugoslavia, my father having been the Czechoslovak ambassador there when I was a little girl, and an awful lot generally about the Balkans. And then what we did, we saw what was happening in terms of ethnic cleansing to the Kosovars and how to really use American power in order to stop this kind of ethnic cleansing. And it wasn't easy to do in any number of ways, first of all, because there was a question in the U.S. government as to whether we should do it. And then internationally, the Russians were going to veto a U.N. mandate. But we managed to go in with NATO. And at the beginning, everything went wrong. We bombed the Chinese embassy by mistake and a variety of things. But now, when I go back to Kosovo, there's a whole generation of little girls whose first name is Madeline, and people are very grateful for what we did.
Chris, there was an episode, and if I'm recalling it right, it was in a bookstore, and there was some Serbians there who got very angry at you, and there was a real, more than a contretemps, it was a bit of a volatile situation.
Well, what happened was when my book came out in Czech, three or four months ago, there are some Czechs who are very pro-Serb, and I think they felt that what we had done in Kosovo was wrong, and that I was anti-Serb, which I definitely was not. My father used to say that if he weren't a Czech, he would have loved to have been a Serb, but I don't equate all Serbs with the kinds of things that Milosevic carried out in Kosovo.
Some thoughts occur to me, in fact, from time to time along the lines of, people have actually said this to me, would it have been better if Tito had stayed in power? Would we have avoided all the bloodshed and all the horror?
Well, it's one of those what-ifs. I mean, the bottom line is that Tito actually was a authoritarian figure that held together a country made up of a number of different republics with different ethnic backgrounds and religions. And it fell apart after Tito died. There's no question about that. But then the intervening period was one where the northern, like the Slovenians that actually had quite a lot of money, did not wish to have their budget redistributed to the south. But the worst thing was Milosevic, who was trying to get his nationalist credentials up by denying the autonomy that even Tito had given to the Kosovars. But, You know, I mean, history moves on, and there's always this question of what if X had stayed in power? That isn't how it works. So the problem was Milosevic.
Talking with former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who has written a memoir, which we're going to talk about, called Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. I need to ask you, though, a couple of other things that are very much in the news right now. I know you're a close personal friend of Secretary of State Clinton, and in fact supported her in her candidacy and said, I think, on the public record that you not only greatly admire her, but you would support her again. What about Benghazi, though? I mean, from your perspective as a former Secretary of State, there are many who feel that it was not her finer moment, and there are things that she should answer for.
Well, I think she's answered every question that's come up. The thing that's very hard, and I identify with this, I loved being Secretary of State. Everybody who knows me knows that. Except on August 7th, 1998, when our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were blown up. And we also had one of those review boards, and the Secretary of State is always ultimately responsible for what goes on. But the bottom line is that clearly there were some failures along the way, and I think that she has answered everything that she can about it. And what has to happen is that more and more we have to figure out how to make it possible for our embassy officials to be able to do their work, which means not sitting behind high walls in fortress-like embassies and at the same time keeping them safe. And so that is the challenge for diplomacy at this time in the 21st century.
You got a lot of heat at that period. In fact, there were supposedly warnings that had gone out about the embassy needing to be protected and you're not being responsive enough, just like she got the same
right.
kind of heat.
And it's all supposedly, because partially what happens is there's something that comes into the State Department and goes to the appropriate assistant secretary. Whether it really gets up to the secretary is one of the major issues. And I think what you try to do is figure out how to make those people within the department responsible for what it is they do. But ultimately, the Secretary of State has to take responsibility for everything. You are the manager of that department.
When you became Secretary of State, one of the major stories was your discovery of the fact that your parents were Jewish, that you had three grandparents who were killed in the Holocaust, and this was something that you had not known. You were raised Catholic, and you write about it in your memoir. Why do you, I mean, there may be a reason you suggest that maybe you didn't ask enough questions and all that, but why did you think your parents kept this?
Well, I can only speculate because when I found out, they were dead already. And the only thing I know is what my parents were like. And they were incredibly protective of me and of my brother and sister. And what I think, and this is, as I say, pure speculation, is that basically we had come to the United States in 1948. My father had defected. He did not want to work for communists. We were in Denver, Colorado, where we were very much a small nuclear family. And I think a lot about, now that I know everything, is how much my parents must have suffered sadness from having returned from England after World War II to find everybody dead. And I think what the reason they didn't talk about it was that they did not want to burden the children with that terrible tragedy and sadness, because everything about them was about protecting us. But that's my only speculation. I do regret not asking questions, but I think that part of it, we always had a complete story. There never were, my parents talked about living in Czechoslovakia and what their life was like, and there never was any reason to doubt that that wasn't the complete story.
Well, there's a big piece missing from that story, though.
Right, very much so.
Major piece. And at this point, what comes across in your memoir, for me as a reader, aside from the fact that you're a good storyteller, is your love of, well, Czechoslovakia, of the Czech people, and of that whole experience of living in the country, and a kind of reverence for Tomáš Masaryk and those who were leaders of, I think, didn't Havel say that he would like you to be a successor at one point? Was he serious about that?
Well, he was. I mean, what happened was that one of my last trips as Secretary of State, he actually planned, and my staff couldn't figure out what we were doing, going to a bunch of small towns and everything. And because he was a playwright, he was setting the stage, and he was taking me to places that where Thomas Garrick Masaryk's mother had lived and where he had lived and various things. And then we're at a press conference, and he actually says, and I would like Madeleine Albright to succeed me. And I kind of looked somewhat stunned, and trying not to be rude, I said, thank you very much, but that I was an American and that it didn't seem appropriate. But he did. And it's interesting, you know, Michael, I had grown up thinking, I think rightfully so, that Czechoslovakia in the interwar period was this golden country that had a democratic government. It was modeled on the United States. It came about as a result of World War I and Woodrow Wilson. And Thomas Garrick Masaryk was a fascinating man. He had married an American and did something that I don't think people would do these days, is he took her maiden name as his middle name. Her name was Charlotte Garrick, so Thomas Garrick Masaryk. The Czechoslovak Constitution was modeled on the American one, with a significant exception. It had equal rights language in it in 1918. And so I grew up kind of thinking what a wonderful country this must have been at that time.
And also realizing, as you became, well, somewhat of a history buff, to be sure, and a scholar, to what extent it had been abandoned. I mean, not only by Britain and France, and not only with respect to Hitler and the Sudetenland, but also by the United States.
Well, in many ways. And I think that here was this little country in the middle of Europe with Germany on its northern borders, and then Poland on one side, Hungary on another, not necessarily all friendly. And then what happened was that the British and French, and this is something that has really come to me as I wrote this book, was how tired the British and French were from World War I. They had lost many, many young men in the war, and they wanted...
The Brits had almost lost a whole generation, really.
Huge numbers. Yeah. And I can now understand better than at the time that I learned this as a child, was that they were so tired from the war and they would have done anything to have peace. And the United States was absent during that 37-38 period, actually all the way until 1941. And the absence of the United States, I think, did make a difference. And basically, the British and French, over the heads of the Czechoslovaks, they never participated in any multinational discussion about this. They sold Czechoslovakia down the river, a small country. And Neville Chamberlain, who I have always thought of as an odious character, had actually said, why should we care about people in a faraway place with unpronounceable names?
Of course, there are those who, Chamberlain has become a kind of villain in many people's minds, who allowed Hitler to continue the process of taking over more and more land and essentially becoming the monster that he did. There are some, curiously enough, there's maybe a kind of historical revisionism that says, well, maybe he was playing for time. He knew the British army wasn't ready, and it wasn't ready, and so certainly not ready for war. So it's trying to put Chamberlain in a different perspective.
I think that's right, and I think that as somebody now of my age and having been a decision maker and understanding how difficult this is, I can see that explanation. There were a number of other things, though, that were going on. As we know, for people that watched Downton Abbey, that there were a lot of pro-German feelings during the time by the British. They did have a problem in terms of how robust, or if at all, they had a defense establishment that could deal with any of this. Plus, I have to say, I can't imagine that any normal human being could have ever figured out what a monster Hitler really was, and that they kind of thought if they provided a little bit more extra room for them, first in the Rhineland and then in Sudetenland, that would satisfy him. So it is beyond anybody's imagination that he turned out to be such a barbarian.
Now, the pain that you certainly point to, on what we could call, for lack of a better way to describe it or characterize it, the Czech psyche, because of Munich, was extraordinary. And yet, under the Soviet occupation, it was a different kind of pain, but it was still pain during those years right after the war. And in fact, I don't know if you, just curious, I was thinking about, I had occasion to be in Prague recently, and I actually was in Havel's apartment, and that's a whole story in itself. But I was struck by the fact that Prague, unlike so much of the other parts of Czechoslovakia, seemed to still have that Soviet kind of mentality or influence. It was as if there had been a shadow cast over it. The people were not friendly, for one thing, but for another thing, they just seemed to be very bureaucratic and what you would expect of a Soviet satellite.
Well, I never had experienced that quite, but I do think that it has such a sad story, because here was this country that wanted in the interwar period to be a democracy and to function as a friend of the West. Then what happens, and it really did affect the psyche, there was a non-aggression treaty that they had signed with the French, that if there was ever a foreign invasion, that the French would come and save them. On March 15th, 1939, the Nazis marched into Prague, and the French did not honor their treaty. The Soviet Union had said that if, in fact, the French honored the treaty, they would also honor a treaty that they had would come in to save Czechoslovakia. Because the French didn't honor their treaty, the Soviets were kind of left off the hook. What had also happened is that, in contrast to the Poles, for instance, the Czech and Slovaks were never anti-Russian, Great Mother Russia, the Slavic mother. And so they felt in many ways that they had not been let down by the Russians and had been let down by the West. And then this psyche of kind of, the Czechoslovaks had wanted to fight after Munich, after the invasion, and President Beneš didn't want make that decision. So they do kind of get themselves into this mood of not resisting. But I think that the thing that cast the shadow was basically 50 years of communism, I think, did affect the psyche a lot in terms of not having a sense that they were masters of their own fate. And democracy is much harder than it looks.
It's still a struggle, in fact.
I think it is a struggle. And one of the things that I always thought was that if the hammer of communism were removed, that they would go back to thinking about their democratic roots. The bottom line is that those 50 years really did affect people's psyche and mentality, and I think that they're a little bit like a turtle that who has withdrawn its head again under the shell.
Well, I mentioned to you before we went on the air Mila Kundera's book, Unbearable Lightness of Being, made in a wonderful movie by Phil Kaufman, a local filmmaker here who lives here in San Francisco, and the feeling of that he communicates as a director, that the actors communicate about Prague Spring, is so filled with hope and filled with that elevated sensibility, which, I don't know, did you experience any of that in the Arab Spring? I mean, we call it Prague Spring, and then suddenly we jump ahead and we see the Arab Spring and the hope for democracy again?
Well, I mean, the thing that happened was that I wrote my dissertation on the Prague Spring, and I wrote about the role of the Czechoslovak press during that period.
Wait, forgive me. Didn't you do some research also on the Polish unions?
I did.
Yes. That was not your dissertation, though.
No, that came afterwards because I had gotten into I'm, as an academic, have always been interested in the role of the media in political change. And so I was able to do those two together. But the bottom line is there was a great deal of hope at that period. And then the Soviets marched in and extinguished it. And then, you know, there were like 20 years or more of normalization, so to speak. I've been often asked whether there's a comparison between the Arab Spring and the Prague, the generally what happened in Central and Eastern Europe. And to some extent, yes, though, at that time, what happened in Central and Eastern Europe was a desire to have identification with the West, to be Europeans. And I think that in the Arab world, that has not been a motivating factor. What is similar is how hard it is, and that we think of democratization as an event when it's actually a process, and it takes a long time. And even after more than 200 years, in the United States, we see it as a process. We have moments that are better than others.
Well, when we look at Syria, when you look at Syria, what are your thoughts about resolving that conflict or bringing it to some kind of stasis or moving toward a democracy, which clearly many of those who are rebelling against Assad want to do, but many of those who are rebelling against Assad may indeed be much more sympathetic to al-Qaeda?
Well, I think there's only a very small number of those, but I think the bottom line here is that our democratic processes may not be exactly the ones that suit them. I do think that people want to be able to make decisions about their own lives. I've always believed that we're all the same and everybody does want to make decisions about their own lives. I am very worried about what's going on in Syria, not only in terms of the number of Syrians that have been killed already, but the refugee camps that are in many ways a great burden on Jordan and on Turkey, and the danger of what's happening in Syria spreading to other parts, to Jordan, Lebanon, and then the part that is most worrisome is the role of Iran in all of this.
And what about the weaponry? I mean, the same problem in Libya, too. There's all that stockpiling that they that was done under Gaddafi, and there's certainly a lot of weaponry in Syria.
There's an awful lot of weaponry, which is one of the aspects of the discussion that goes on as to whether the United States and the West should be providing more arms to the opposition groups. Because according to some things that I've read, there are enough weapons in there. That isn't the issue. But in terms of where I think that we are doing the right thing is providing non-lethal assistance, and the U.S. has been very generous on that, to the refugees and the opposition groups in terms of supporting them as they try to figure out how to make it clear to Assad that it's time for him to go.
And when you mention Iran, I think you have said publicly, haven't you, that you think the sanctions are working now?
I do think the sanctions are working, but let me do something with you, Michael, which is you mentioned that I was a professor. I teach a course about our national security toolbox. What is it that a president has in that toolbox that he or she can work with in order to change the behavior of a particular country? So there's not a lot in the toolbox. There is diplomacy, bilateral and multilateral, which we're about to try again in Kazakhstan next week. There are the economic tools, which are carrots like aid and trade and sticks like sanctions. There's the threat of the use of force, law enforcement, and intelligence. And the bottom line is that the president has made clear that containment is not a policy and that all the options, i.e. all the tools, are on the table. So I do think that the sanctions, which are now what we call targeted sanctions, are in fact effective in terms of isolating Iran, making it more difficult for them to get technology in a number of different ways, cutting down the oil that they can export. And so I think that that is a tool while keeping the threat of the use of force in the toolbox, but making clear that it's available.
Sanctions, well, when you were in the Clinton administration, the sanctions against Iraq were criticized heavily, and now there's sanctions against Cuba are continuing to be criticized. But they're also criticized by some who say they're not efficacious enough or they don't really have enough clout or teeth to them. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this, particularly in light of when you talk about the toolbox. I think about the United Nations, and you were the ambassador. The United Nations certainly got involved in Libya. There was bombing there. Some would say effectual, but limited in so many other ways.
Well, I think that one of the things we learned from the Iraq sanctions is to do, instead of having overall sanctions, and by the way, let me say, on sanctions, they're never, even if you have complete sanctions, they never include humanitarian food and medicine. But when there are these complete sanctions, they're a little bit of a blunt instrument. So what we did during the wars in the Balkans, learn about what these SMART or targeted sanctions, that they were better, because what they did was to be specifically directed against the leadership and the cronies and those who want, they can't travel, they can't have bank accounts, and so they are much more targeted. And in Cuba, there are a lot of questions as to how effective the embargo has been. And so there are a lot of now travel and a variety of things that are going on. So I think we've learned a lot about sanctions. And but I think one of the issues really is what are the right tools and how do you use them?
We're coming up on a break here, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to talk with you. Let me do that. Let me invite you to join us with Madeleine Albright. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us toll-free again at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, spending the hour with former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, talking a little bit about the Russian language and my name, which means red in Russian and beautiful in Slavic. And well, your name originally, when Bill Clinton said, I'll tell that story. when he asked you to say something that he didn't know about you?
Yeah. Well, what happened was right after we were all named in the first term, and I was a member of the cabinet because of being UN ambassador, and we all went, he invited us to Camp David for a weekend. And one of the things he said, we were all together, and he said, "Can you tell me something about yourself that I don't know?" And so I said, "My name is not Madeleine Albright. I'm Maria Jana Korbilova."
And you're still known in the Czech Republic as Madalenka?
Yes.
That was what Havel, I mean, it's a very affectionate name.
Yeah, right? Well, it's one of those diminutives, and so they always say Naše Madalenka or Madeleine.
Well, we're going to go to your calls and emails, and again, you can join us with Madam Secretary. You still call that, aren't you?
Occasionally, yes. It has a nice ring to it.
It does, and if I assume if people can still be called after years of Newt Gingrich still called Mr. Speaker, you can still be called Madam Secretary. By the way, you are welcome to join us. Toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and there are a number of other ways to join the program if you can't get through our email address, forum@kqed.org, or our website, kqed.org/forum. Simply click on this segment, and you can also join us by going to our Facebook page or by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. A lot of things that people probably don't know about you, like that you were on the Gilmore Girls, that you have a pin collection in Denver, which fascinatingly enough has the Golden Serpent pin has a story behind it too, because didn't Saddam Hussein call you
right
essentially, what do you call you, a serpent unlike any other serpent?
Well, what happened was I do have this pin collection, and it's a traveling collection. At the moment, it's at the Gerald Ford Library in Grand Rapids. But I say none of it would have happened if it hadn't been for Saddam Hussein, because I had gone to the UN, and we talked about sanctions earlier, and my job was to make sure that the sanctions that had been the translation of the ceasefire into these six sanctions resolutions, that they stayed on. And my instructions were to say perfectly terrible things about Saddam Hussein constantly, which he deserved. He'd invaded Kuwait.
So killed so many of his own people and tortured them.
A really horrible human being. And so what happened was all of a sudden a poem appeared in the papers in Baghdad comparing me to many things, but among them an unparalleled serpent. And I happened to have a snake pin, so I wore it when we were talking about Iraq. And then, you know, the way the ambassadors go out afterwards and talk to the press, so somebody zeroed in and said, "Why do you have that snake pin?" And I said, "Because Saddam Hussein compared me to an unparalleled serpent." And then I thought, well, this is fun. So I went out and I bought a lot of pins that reflected what I thought we were going to do on any given day. So,
well, that was a badge of honor, too, wasn't it?
It was pretty good. Yeah. And so on good days, I wore flowers and butterflies and balloons, and on bad days, kinds of insects and various carnivorous animals.
I'm noticing you have kind of a pin on your lapel this morning. It looks like looks like San Francisco.
No, it's actually Prague.
Is it Prague?
In a flea market in Prague, and it's actually that view of Prague that you see when you look up at the castle.
I have to ask you, before we go to our callers, and lots of people want to talk with you, and emails coming in, of course, and we'll get some listener response here, just about drones, because you have said they're effective in fighting terrorism, and yet, you know, as you certainly are well acquainted and aware, they've come under serious kind of scrutiny, particularly because of lack of transparency, now that the administration's essentially defense has been made public to a great degree, and because they seem to many people to violate due process, and American citizens have been involved. And so your thoughts?
Well, I think, like everything, it's a complicated subject. And let me just say, we talked earlier about Kosovo. And we in Kosovo decided, President Clinton had said no boots on the ground. And so what we were doing in the end was an air war. And there were a number of people who said, this is immoral. You should have boots on the ground. And I thought, why did we need to get our people killed in order to stop the killing that Milosevic was doing of the Kosovars? And so, but there were questions about an air war. So in many ways, the drone is kind of an extension of some of that. I do think that it has been effective. It is a way for people that have been trying to kill us to be removed. I do think, however, that there now are a great many questions about it, how the decisions are made, and I am sure that it is not an easy decision for President Obama to make.
And it's a decision that often winds up with collateral damage and people dying who aren't even necessarily being targeted.
Well, and yes, we certainly read about that. The question is about the I mean, I'm very glad we're having this discussion because I think it's an important discussion to have. I think there is the issue about an American citizen that actually was killed with a drone. From everything that I read about it, he was somebody that was targeting the United States. So the question is, how do you decide? What intelligence do you have? Are you sure that the person that you're killing is somebody that is about to attack the United States? And I can tell you, this was not with drones, but with cruise missiles. Remember, we talked about our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania being attacked. So at that time, we knew it was Osama bin Laden, and we were making decisions about whether to launch cruise missiles into Afghanistan to get him. And what would happen is you'd get intelligence that would indicate that a tall person dressed in white was in a particular building, and then you'd find out that there were women and children in it, and we desisted. And so it is one of those really difficult issues, and the question is whether you have intelligence, and the intelligence is the Achilles heel.
Oh, we had intelligence that told us that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Well, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the problem.
Plus, we're hitting wedding parties in Afghanistan now.
No, there's no question. And I think, though, that most people would like us to eliminate those that are trying to kill us. And what is the most effective way? But I think that the most important thing now is for people to I fully agree with the transparency aspect and the need to have a public discussion about this.
Let's bring our callers in and have a public discussion with them. And we begin with Jason. Good morning.
Good morning. Dobry rano.
Dobry rano.
So I had a two-part kind of comment, but I want to rephrase my second comment out of the question. The first thing was I just came back from living for about 14 months in Prague, and one thing I found, like in referring to Mr. Krasny's comment about a lot of people have the experience of the Czechs being sort of cold and standoffish in their personalities, but the trick is really learning just a tiny bit of the Czech language, which is really difficult, but it does help. And once they warm up to you, you really, really can have a special experience there.
So my name is Krasny. I thought they would be embracing me, but it didn't happen.
Well, it all depends on kind of where you are. When you're right in the center of town, you're lumped in with all the rest of the tourists, you know?
There's a lot of tourists in Prague now, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. There's a lot of them there. And my second comment, which I'd like to rephrase as a question, was I've kind of been thinking about this for a while, and I'm very interested, and my question is to Madam Secretary Albright about what her opinion is, as these generations that were directly affected by, in less numbers, Nazi Germany, but in more numbers, the communist occupation of Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia at the time, as these generations are getting older and passing on, you know, I'm very interested to see the effect of when this court sort of stigma, this shadow of the negative parts of their history is sort of hopefully lifted out of the population without much new terrors coming through, you know. I mean, like once the people that were, you know, had a very bad experience under communism, sadly, when they're gone, that history is gone, but it also doesn't reflect so much in the current population. And I'll take my comments off the air. I'm just curious to see her sense on the future of that nation as well as others.
All right, Jason,
it's
thank
sort
you.
Of a microcosm.
Thank you for
thank
the call.
Thank you. And I have to say, I obviously don't experience the coldness of the Czechs. They're very nice to me when I walk around there. They treat me, actually, as some combination of a queen and an irritating older sister. But I do think it takes a while for people to warm up.
Plus, they know you. I mean,
they know you
as a public figure.
No. But I really do think you've asked a very important question, because part of the book has come out in Czech. And so I was just there and I was talking to some students at Charles University, and they actually do not know a lot about their history, which I found very interesting. I think the question, though, is to what extent does the cloud of communism stay with them? And the more that they are travel and have an education in other parts of the world, I think that they are very likely to be more empowered and entranced by democracy and the possibility of making their own decisions. What has happened, though, is that they are somewhat cynical, and this is a huge generalization, about the corruption that's taking place. I think that that is very depressing to them. But I do think that some of the cloud of their past is lifting.
Well, speaking about the fact that you're known in Prague by sight, probably, and the fact that too many young Czechs don't know about their history, our engineer, Danny Bringer, was saying to me just the other day that some of I guess some of the neighbors and kids in his family who were younger, he kind of quizzed them, who's Madeleine Albright?
Yeah.
And they don't know their history either, apparently.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Let me look at some of the tweets and Facebook comments that are coming in. Karen writes, Madeleine Albright is a hero and inspiration to so many women, but my love of her hit new heights when she appeared on the TV show The Gilmore Girls sometime around 2005. Kimberly tweets, being our former U.N. ambassador, then Secretary of State, what was your reaction to the non-nomination firestorm around Susan Rice?
Well, I thought it was regretful. I'd known Susan since she was 4 years old. I think that she is a remarkably qualified and smart person and has been doing a great job as the U.N. ambassador. And I think it was a not a very pleasant experience for anybody, but she is genuinely qualified and a wonderful human being. She was Assistant Secretary for Africa when I was Secretary of State, and I was delighted to have her in that position.
Another listener writes, why is the world standing by as tens of thousands are slaughtered in Syria? Is there no U.S. interest in saving Syrians?
Well, I think it's a very troubling question, and one of the things that I have been working on now is a doctrine that's come out, which is called responsibility to protect. And one of the things one could argue, I would not be a person that would say that we did not know what was going on in Germany during or generally in Eastern Europe as a result of World War II. We now do know everything about what's happening everywhere. And so the UN has come up with this doctrine of responsibility to protect. If a leader is not only not protecting his people but killing them, then the international community does have some responsibility. And the question is, who carries it out? Is there some kind of international way to stop the killing? But it is a tragedy to watch it. I fully agree. And I do think that the U.S. is trying what we can in terms of the humanitarian assistance and trying to figure out how to press to have Assad leave.
Well, what's your general sense, though, of the what has been characterized and indicted, really, is the inefficacy of the United Nations, and particularly not only when it comes to certain actions of this sort, but, you know, there are those particularly on the right who see the United Nations not only as an ineffective body, but as an organization that is largely, particularly in the General Assembly, ruled by states that are, shall we say, not exactly friendly toward the United States.
Well, I think, you know, the United Nations, people talk about it as if it were an independent entity. What it is a combination of nation states. And you're absolutely right. There are numbers of them that do not like us. But I think that it is an organization that has its successes and its failures. We are the founders of the United Nations here in San Francisco. And I think it should be made more effective. But I do know there are groups of people who think that the UN has helicopters that swoop down in the middle of the night and steal your lawn furniture. And then there are people who don't like the UN because it's full of foreigners, which frankly can't be helped. So it is an organization, I think, that we would reinvent if it didn't exist. And we need to work to make it more effective.
So that's what those helicopters are after, the furniture.
Right.
I hadn't realized that until now. Facebook questions for you. Jeff asks, why was so little done on Ms. Albright's watch to mitigate climate change? And what advice does she have for Secretary Kerry on what he can do to get the nations of the world to mitigate climate change? In fact, a number of listeners want to know what advice you'd give to John Kerry.
Well, first of all, we began a lot of the climate change discussion with the Kyoto Protocols and tried to figure out how, in fact, to move with the Chinese in order to change the dimension of it. I do think that President Obama has made very clear that he wants to push harder on climate change in the second term. He talked about it in his inaugural address, which was very important that he put it in there. I also do know that Secretary Kerry is very interested in climate change. He's a very good friend of mine. He lives around the corner, and we have often talked about climate change issues. And
he talked about it on the air here.
Well,
he seemed very committed to it.
He is committed to it. And so I think the combination of the president's push on it and Secretary Kerry's, I think we will see some action on it.
Do you have any thoughts about why? I mean, you were confirmed 99-0. Senator Kerry is going to probably, needless to say, sail through in terms of his nomination.
Yeah.
Why is it that Senator Hagel is having such difficulty, particularly since President Obama presumably is reaching across aisles here? He's got a Republican who's not necessarily a Republican that the Republicans are all that championing, but he's had some terrible difficulties.
I always kid about the fact the one vote that wasn't there for me was Senator Jay Rockefeller, who was traveling, and so we often talk about the fact that
you would have had 100,
I would have had a perfect score. Yeah. I think that part of the problem here is, first of all, I think Senator Hagel is obviously highly qualified to take the job and somebody that has, I think, the trust of the president. And he is a decorated war hero. What I think has happened here is just very cruel party politics that's happening. And I find it quite shocking in terms of the way that he is being treated. And I hope very much that he is confirmed soon.
There was a lot of puzzlement in the press about why he was selected, especially since cabinet positions are often, most often, of course, with few exceptions, from one's own party. And I was reading one article that suggested, well, he's really on board with President Obama about, first of all, the possibility of talking to Iran and opening up talks with Iran. And secondly, sort of having a dislike of Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, this is speculation, but the idea is, in other words, they really see things in similar ways with Iran and Israel.
Well, I think they got to know each other, and I do not know in terms of the issue. President's going to Israel. I think that he wants to move forward in what has been one of the crucial relationships in American history of our indissoluble friendship and alliance with Israel. I think, and I know, Senator Hagel feels the same way about it. I think that one of the issues that's out there, and I know Senator Hagel to be an internationalist. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee when I was secretary. We spent a lot of time together. He has done an awful lot of work in international policy. But clearly, at some stage, he and when there was Senator Obama, that they had formed some kind of a link and they have a trust. What is interesting is that in the Clinton administration, we had a Republican senator as the Secretary of Defense, Bill Cohen. Bob Gates was a Republican. And I think that what President Obama wants to signal is that he wants to have a policy, a bipartisan or nonpartisan foreign policy.
Is there any way you think under the second administration of President Obama there can be real breakthrough in terms of the Middle East?
I think that there will be more efforts made towards that end, but ultimately what has to happen is that the United States cannot dictate a plan. The parties have to understand each other and try to develop it. The United States can do what we talked about. We're kind of bridging ideas of ways that one side could see more the needs of the other. President Obama is going to Israel and to the region to talk about, as I understand it, Syria and Iran, but obviously there will be some discussion. Then Secretary Kerry is going to be going also to the region. So I do think that there will be some attempt at progress towards a two-state solution.
Are you hopeful about the fact that there may be a different coalition in Israel as a result of the last elections that includes the followers of Lapid, who are more, shall we say, progressive?
Well, they're working on everything now. What I find interesting, and again, I think it's hard at this moment to know exactly what's happening, but I read that Tzipi Livni, who had been foreign minister previously, is now going to have, I think they said justice minister, but that she does believe in a two-state solution. As I understand it, the coalition is going to have to be somewhat different.
Well, Netanyahu says he believes in a two-state solution.
Well, but I think that I think it's hard to say what the coalition will look like until it actually does exist. But clearly, some of the further right-wing people that had been in Prime Minister Netanyahu's previous coalition government are not going to be there. I don't know why I say clearly. Nothing's clearly. What I believe is that it will be a little bit different. But I also think that it would be very good to try to move the process forward on this.
Again, we're talking with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Her new book is out and available. It is called Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. And let me go up to Sonoma. Tim, join us.
Yeah, Ambassador Albright. Thank you for taking my call. Two things. This is a little overwhelming to be speaking to a figure as yourself. Two things. How do you reconcile the allegations by people like Ramsey Clark and Amnesty International for the actions of the Clinton administration towards Iraq? The general overview is, yeah, sanctions are a great way to not have to fight and try to get, bad people to do good things. But the evidence was pretty outstanding that there were a lot of innocents being affected by those sanctions. And I wonder how you, like I say, reconcile with the statements of Ramsey. Secondly, and this is a hot one here, there are more and more people that are beginning to believe that the 9/11 report was a complete fraud. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. Thank you.
On the first point, let me just say that one of the things that I had said earlier, actually, and just to repeat, is the sanctions resolutions were put in initially by the first Bush administration at the end of the Gulf War. And they were designed in a way to deal with what had fighting terrorism, making sure that the weapons of mass destruction were dismantled, etc. One of the things that was absolutely clear when I got to the UN was that, in fact, there were exceptions for humanitarian goods, which is food and medicine. And the question was, who was going to pay for it? How would it be distributed? And Saddam Hussein would not allow any, first of all, he wouldn't pay for anything. And second, he would not allow any distribution of food and medicine to the people who really needed it. And so that was the ongoing struggle that went on throughout the entire time. But it is not the United States that was responsible for the suffering of the Iraqi people. It was Saddam Hussein's responsibility. And I just think it's important to clarify the fact that in any full embargo or sanctions resolution, there is always that exclusion for food and medicine. And as I said, we learned a lot about having more targeted sanctions later. I was the first witness to testify for the in front of the 9/11 Commission. I think they did a very good job in trying to identify what had really happened, and then trying to take various steps that would make sure that nothing like that ever happened again. So I do not think it was a complete fraud.
Well, with respect to Iraq, I remember that whole incident that occurred with Leslie Stahl asking you about the million children who died and was it worth the price, and you saying, yes, it was worth the price, and suddenly all of this wrath and anger and enmity came down on you.
Well, I have to say, first of all, it was one of my early appearances, but mostly I have said this over and over again, is that it was really the stupidest comment I have ever made. And I have said to people that if they have never said anything that they regret, I wish they would tell me. But I have apologized for the statement. I think that there's kind of a cottage industry out there of people that keep reminding me of it. But the bottom line is it was a dumb, dumb comment.
Don't mean to join the cottage industry here. I was reminded of it because it does come back to
haunt you. It comes back all the time. And the bottom line is I have apologized, and it was really, really a dumb comment.
Well, I respect you for saying that. I must say, there are too many people of high position who are unwilling to state that they were wrong or that they were foolish or stupid or made a mistake. We were obviously stupid and foolish with respect to Iraq and believing that the weapons of mass destruction were there. But now we know that there is a despot with weapons of mass destruction. I'm talking, of course, about North Korea. You went to North Korea. You visited his father. And what are we doing? We're not doing anything, really, from at least it's visible.
Well, I think we've been trying all along. And the North Korean story is a very long one, and something that I witnessed personally from 1993 on when I got to the United Nations, which is that at that stage, the North Koreans were going to pull out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We were trying to figure out how to make them abide by various aspects of it. I won't go through the whole history, but we have been pushing at them for a very long time. I have to say, in my case, we were in the middle of negotiations with the father, Kim Jong-il, when the Bush administration came in and basically changed the rules of the game. I think at this stage need the help of other countries, specifically China, in trying to get the North Koreans to understand that they are going down the wrong road. And the Chinese are the only ones that we think have any power over them because they actually deliver oil and various aspects to them. On the other hand, the Chinese are afraid of the disintegration of the regime because they don't want to see millions of refugees crossing their borders. But you would think that they would be the first ones not to want to have a nuclear power next door to them.
Well, so, with this latest explosion or test or whatever you want to call it, the Chinese were surprised about it, at least publicly. Of course, they were surprised maybe to find out that they were hacking in Shanghai, too. But, I mean, that was at least for public consumption.
Well, I think that they... First of all, we don't know what kind of conversations the Chinese have been having with the North Koreans. But it is very... We are involved in a very bad situation because, to go back to my toolbox, you know, foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. And you try to figure out what the tool is that works. And at the moment, we do have sanctions on the North Koreans because part of what we don't want them to do is to export some of their nuclear technology because that's their only cash crop. And so the question is, we're worried about any links between the Iranians and North Koreans. And we also need help from the South Koreans in terms of putting pressure on them. But it is a very, very tough situation and something that the Obama administration and Secretary Kerry, everybody's going to have to work on.
And we don't even know what Kim Jong-un is like or what kind of power he has. I mean, he's a kid, really. He's kind of a blank slate to us in many respects. Seems to be following his father, but a lot is mysterious.
Very mysterious. I mean, basically, we don't even know how old he is. But what he is clearly trying to do is to establish his preeminence over the military there, trying to prove that he is the divinely appointed son of this hereditary dictatorship. And I think that the military there, what is so horrible is that they are given everything that they need in terms of weapons, and they have a million-man army. And meanwhile, the normal, ordinary people are eating bark off the trees. So it is a disgusting place. And the bottom line is we have a very hard time trying to figure out what the tool is that we can have some influence over them.
Well, Madam Secretary, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for being with us. Prague Winter, it's a number one national bestseller, personal story of remembrance and war, 1937 and 1948. Good to see you again.
Great to be with you, Michael. Thank you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll and executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.